I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Facing growing anti-war sentiment across the country and within his own party, President Bush today urged Congress again to give his Iraq strategy more time. The president made his latest appeal at a press conference this morning. It came as a White House report acknowledged only mixed results in Iraq since President Bush ordered an increase in U.S. troop strength, the so-called surge. The report cites satisfactory progress in 8 of 18 benchmarks that the White House set for Iraq. But it says security in the country remains extremely challenging, the economic picture uneven, and political reconciliation lagging. But the president urged Congress and the country to be patient.
It doesn't surprise me that there is deep concern amongst our people. Part of that concern is whether or not we can win, whether or not the objective is achievable. People don't want our troops in harm's way if that which we're trying to achieve can't be accomplished. I feel the same way. I cannot look a mother and father of a troop in the eye and say, I'm sending your kid into combat, but I don't think we can achieve the objective. I wouldn't do that to a parent or a husband or a wife of a soldier. I believe we can succeed, and I believe we are making security progress that will enable the political track to succeed as well.
President Bush speaking this morning in Washington. And joining us now from Washington is Richard Wolff. He's a senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. What struck you most about today's news conference and the president's demeanor?
Well, I think he was trying yet again to express his sympathy, or empathy, rather, with where the American people are on this war. He talked about how there's war fatigue in America, and it affects everyone's psychology. There's an ugly war. But at the same time, he was saying, as he always has done, that the costs of defeat, as he put it, were even higher than the current costs. So, yes, he was asking for more time, but he was also, I think, trying to balance it out with a certain expression of understanding.
Mm. As we mentioned in the intro just a moment ago, today's press conference comes as the White House released this report, this interim report about progress in Iraq since the start of the surge. I was wondering if you could give us some of the highlights. What did this report say specifically? What's going well? What's not going so well?
Well, in the White House's view, what's going well is that there is some progress on the security side. These joint checkpoints are being set up effectively, and the one area they point to is Anbar province, where local tribal leaders have joined with American forces to go against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, as the president, you have to listen carefully, because the president said this was bottom-up many times. He kept saying it was bottom-up. This is something that really happened almost independently of the surge. It predates the so-called surge. Hmm. And it's not top-down, which is where the political progress has been slow or non-existent. And according to these benchmarks, really the political progress has not taken place. That's what the surge was meant to achieve. It was supposed to buy time for Iraq's politicians to get their act together. And from that perspective, this report is pretty damning.
Interesting. And of course, his point is to wait until September when we get the full report from General David Petraeus. Any indication of what we would expect the president to say at that point?
We expect him to say there's been progress on more benchmarks. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, he doesn't just want people to give them time until September, because nobody in the White House, including the president, thinks this is going to be substantially different in terms of what the violence is like in Iraq come September. He wants to keep on buying time all the way through to the end of his presidency. And so, you know, there is this constant buying a little bit of extra time, trying mm-hmm. to keep Congress off his back, and especially trying to keep the 60 votes, stop the Democrats from getting 60 votes that they need to push things forward, to push debate forward on especially cutting off funding for the war. This is the kind of cat and mouse game we're going to see inside Washington, I think, for the rest of his presidency.
Well, how does it affect that you were just referring to? The House today is set to vote on a measure to end combat operations next year. Did anything the president have to say today, will it have an effect on that? Will it convince any of his critics to think again and change their minds?
No, I don't believe it will, especially in the House, where, remember, the Republican opinion is more entrenched than it is in terms of the Senate. And remember, another point, it's not just enough for the Democrats even to get 60 votes in the Senate or a majority in the House. In the end, if they come up with legislation that coerces or tries to coerce the president to end the war, he will veto that legislation. And that means that they have to come up with 67 votes in the Senate to overcome the veto. They are a very long way away from doing that. That's why the president is essentially staying the course, at least this course that he's adopted, that he calls the surge. He does not think that he is politically imperiled enough to do anything different.
You know, it struck me, too. I watched a good deal of the press conference. He seems as confident as ever. He seems not to be in the least bit bowed about what is going on in Iraq, despite the news, which continues to be somewhat discouraging. He seems to just be full speed ahead and confident as ever. Was that your take about what you saw today?
Well, I think there are two aspects of this, because this is a personal thing for him. And one aspect is his answer when he encouraged one of the reporters to come visit him when he's tired and old in Crawford. And he would say at that point that he acted on principle and not on polls. That's something very important to the president's self-image. I don't entirely believe it, because this is a White House that has spent historically a huge amount of money on polls and passing the polls. So put that aside for 1 minute. He thinks he's acting on principle. The second aspect of it is that the visits with the troops, wounded troops it was this week, bereaved families on regular occasions, he said today that he draws inspiration from that. Yes, part of it is inspiration, but part of it is also reinforcement of his own feelings, his own gut feelings, to use Michael Chertoff's phrase, his own gut feelings about the righteousness of his position. And so there is a personal drive behind this that trumps, in his own mind, I think, any of the details, the reports, the numbers of dead that is coming out of Iraq.
I want to ask you about one other thing the president said. He talked about there was a reference to the soon-to-be-released National Intelligence Estimate, which is the focus of a White House meeting today. It reportedly says that al-Qaeda has regrouped to its pre-9/11 strength. Let's listen to what the president had to say about that.
There is a perception in the coverage that that al-Qaeda may be as strong today as they were prior to September the 11th. That's just simply not the case. I think the report will say, you know, since 2001, not prior to September the 11th, 2001. Secondly, that because of the actions we've taken, al-Qaeda is weaker today than they would have been.
What do you make of that, Richard? We only have a few seconds left, but I'm just very curious to know what you make of that statement.
Well, I don't think it's true, and it doesn't square with the president's own intelligence agencies, which have said that al-Qaeda has grown and changed and that the core leadership is just doing fine and well in the tribal areas of Pakistan. But look, this is something the president has established his credentials on, his reputation, and it's not surprising to me that he's portraying his record on al-Qaeda as being stronger than his own intelligence agency says it is.
Okay, Richard Wolff. Well, as always, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. That's Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, joining us from Washington. We're going to stay in Washington now. The president's choice to be the 18th U.S. Surgeon General is testifying today before the Senate Health Committee. Dr. James Holsinger is a professor of health science at the University of Kentucky. He's also the former head of the health department for the state of Kentucky and a former undersecretary of health in the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Drew Armstrong is covering the hearing for Congressional Quarterly, and he joins us now. And Drew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So give us the highlights. What jumps out at you so far in the hearings?
Well, there's been a lot of questions about a 1991 paper that Dr. Holsinger wrote called The Physiopathology of Male Homosexuality, where he goes into some rather explicit detail on certain sexual practices, and it was written for the United Methodist Church and is seen by a lot of pro-gay and pro-lesbian activists as being a real black mark on his reputation as someone whose science-based views will be able to trump his ideological views as a religious man and a spokesperson for the administration.
Well, listen, we have a cut of tape that we'd like to play that pertains to this very question. So let's listen to that and then talk a little more about this.
In 2002, I came under intense fire politically in the Commonwealth of Kentucky because our Women's Health Center was holding a conference in which a major section of it was dealing with the needs, the health needs of our lesbian population. I believe absolutely that everyone who is a practitioner needs to understand the health needs of our gay and lesbian community in an effort to be able to provide quality health care to all individuals. And so I fought fiercely for that, even though I had a huge political pushback on it. In fact, our budget was actually being threatened in the state legislature.
Drew, did that satisfy his Senate questioners?
Well, I think to an extent, that and also his efforts to back away from the paper to an extent. Early in the hearing, he said that the paper was taken out of context, that it was meant for a closed audience of church members. And then later on, he made the point to Senator Kennedy, who was running the hearings, that the paper does not represent his views anymore, and that while it might have represented his views at the time, that he's backed off of them, it doesn't represent where he or his science is at this point. Mm. I think he's done his best to step away from this thing, because it really is sort of the really, you know, the hot potato issue for him.
Yeah. Another hot potato issue, I guess, is the independence of the Surgeon General's office. And this concern comes after three former Surgeon Generals complained earlier this week about political pressure from the White House. How did Holsinger respond to those kinds of concerns? How independent he would be from the president?
Well, I think he did it in two ways. The first way, he very clearly and directly told the panel that if there was an issue where he felt that his science was being overruled or was trying to be altered in the way that the previous Surgeon Generals testified earlier in the week, they had faced the pressures to have done. He said that he would try to work with the administration and make them see his point of view first, and then if that was not possible, that he would then resign. I mean, he made that very, very clear that he was willing to step down when he felt that good science was going to be trumped by politics.
Interesting. Drew, let's stand by for a second. Let's listen to what he said specifically about this. Here we go.
I think that you must balance those. I think we cannot have unfettered science without moral and ethical implications being looked at on all of those kinds of things. I think that it's clear that there are balances. I think we cannot have simply unfettered moral or ethical things that depend on our individual propensities. I think we need to work together to come to a consensus around the best approach to meet the needs of Americans and to meet our own moral and ethical standards as a people.
So, Drew, where are we with this confirmation process? Does it look like Holsinger is going to be confirmed?
You know, I think that there may still be some problems. The 1991 paper is just, in a lot of ways, almost too explicit and just too really hot for some senators possibly to be able to get over. I think he needs to be concerned about that. Mm. But at the same time, he took a lot of viewpoints today, and he made a lot of statements that I think alleviated many concerns.
Well, Drew, thanks so much for helping us. Drew Armstrong is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. He's covering Senate confirmation hearings for Surgeon General nominee Dr. James Holsinger. More ahead on Here and Now. Brooks, it's Here and Now. We've been talking about the Senate confirmation hearings this morning for James Holsinger, the Bush administration's nominee to become the country's new Surgeon General. For more perspective on the role of the Surgeon General, we now turn to Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Lori, welcome.
Hi.
Can you start off by just telling us, does the Surgeon General have a real role to play in the creation of public health policy?
Well, probably one of the most important breakthroughs in public health that had global ramifications was the Surgeon General's report on smoking, which came out during the Johnson administration. And we've subsequently had Surgeon Generals really lead the charge against the tobacco industry in quite valiant ways. C. Everett Koop was, of course, responsible for getting the whole issue of secondhand smoke and smoking in public places and the exposure to babies put high on the agenda. And I think that the Surgeon Generals have traditionally had a somewhat more independent stature that allowed them to take on major industries like big tobacco when other sectors of our health establishment and the White House would have greater difficulty doing so.
The outgoing Surgeon General Richard Carmona testified earlier this week that his hands were tied on issues ranging from the use of condoms to stem cell research. Here's some of his testimony.
I was blocked at every turn. I was told a decision had already been made. Stand down, don't talk about it. In speeches where that information was put in speeches, it was removed.
Laurie, is this new, or haven't former surgeons general also been subjected to political pressure? You mentioned Koop, for example. He testified as well, saying that he was subjected to political pressure in the past from his boss, Ronald Reagan.
Right. Surgeon generals have always been controversial slots, but that's sort of the beauty of the position. I mean, in theory, they can stand up as the spokesperson for the doctors of the nation. And C. Everett Koop definitely took advantage of that. I mean, here was a guy who was appointed by Ronald Reagan because he looked like a perfect right-winger. He'd actually made a movie called Silent Scream, in which he stood inside of the ovens in Auschwitz, filled the ovens with little baby dolls, and said, this is what abortion is. And then he absolutely boomeranged on them. He turned out to be the most pronounced critic of the tobacco industry there had ever been in that position. And once he saw babies dying of AIDS, this was a man whose whole life had been dedicated to pediatrics, and he started coming out in favor of AIDS prevention and treatment programs, tried to put out a massive mailer across the nation related to AIDS, and the White House tried to block it. And he was able to use his sort of bully pulpit power to override the White House. David Satcher got blocked on AIDS as well, and in his case it had to do with IV drug users and the availability of sterile syringes, which remains an enormous problem, with Congress having blocked not only all federal money for use of sterile syringes by IV drug users inside the United States, but also the use of foreign aid monies to assist in lowering the rates of HIV among drug users through any means that would allow them safe access to syringes.
That's David Satcher, who served as Surgeon General under President Clinton, you're referring to.
But, Anthony, the issue here is not Carmona. I mean, his testimony was very important, and it should be striking to anyone who really thinks about who he is as a man who served in the military, who's a deep patriot, and who was brought up professionally to know that you don't disagree publicly with your commander-in-chief.
Yeah, good soldier, yes. Right.
So for him to go before Congress and lay this out is very striking. He had to have been pushed right over the edge.
But I'm wondering if he should have just resigned or spoken up more forcefully. I mean, I take your point that this at this point isn't so much about Carmona, but The Wall Street Journal ran an editorial today saying, if he really felt that way, why didn't he speak up? Why didn't he resign?
Look, at this moment, I think you have to step back from the Carmona, and let's look at what we've seen happen with this administration that has affected global health and national health policies. The White House blocked the appointment of Tom Scully in 2001 to the Centers for Medicare because he had donated money to the Democratic Party. Then in 2004, they blocked the appointment of Dr. Howard Zucker as Deputy HHS Secretary. This is a guy who got through his entire medical degree by the age of 22. Again, he was blocked because he had made a $2,000 total donation over a period of years to the Democratic Party. In 2004, they instituted a travel policy that said absolutely nobody employed within the Public Health Service of the United States government, including any scientists at the NIH, could travel any distance, including a subway ride, to meet with a health representative of a multilateral agency, meaning any UN agency, Global Fund, World Bank, you name it, without prior written approval from an office inside HHS that vetted it for political allegiances.
Laurie, let me ask you this, though. As you know, some in Congress are calling for Congress to take steps to insulate the Office of the Surgeon General from political influence. I gather you would think that's a good idea. Is it practicable? Is there a way that could work, do you think?
Well, again, I would say it goes well beyond the Surgeon General.
Sure.
I mean, we have...
But it might be a good place to start. Right.
It might be. I mean, certainly, I think the Surgeon General ought to be, sort of the Supreme Court for medical decision-making, if you will. You know, the Surgeon General ought to have a decent staff, a good independent budget, a large office. None of this is true at the moment. And be able to stand up and say, you know, the Surgeon General's office has assessed X and determined that the best way to handle it is in the following way. We haven't had that for many years, and it's not just this administration that has gutted the Surgeon General's office. It's been an erosion over time.
What can the new Surgeon General do to make his or her position more relevant?
Well, I think as long as this administration is in office, nothing, because nobody is going to allocate funds to allow the Surgeon General's office to grow. It's going to have to be about figuring out ways to detach ideology from the Surgeon General's office and make the Surgeon General's office a real center of evidence-based medicine, scientifically grounded principles and analysis.
Well, Lori Garrett, thanks very much for taking time today to talk to us.
Thank you.
That's Lori Garrett. She's a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. You're listening to Here and Now. Anthony Brooks, it's Here and Now. Americans use 380 billion plastic bags each year, and it takes 100 million barrels of oil to make those bags. They are not biodegradable, and barely 1% of them get recycled. That's why several countries and many American cities are trying to curb the use of plastic bags. Here in Massachusetts, a proposed law would charge shoppers a fee every time they take a plastic bag home. If passed, it would be the first statewide law of its kind. The bill was inspired by one woman, and Here and Now's Meghna Chakrabarty has her story.
Meet Janet Martin.
I'm the one-woman crusade against the plastic bag.
She's no ordinary crusader. Martin doesn't wear dreadlocks, there's no whiff of patchouli about her, no bumper sticker reading, bikes not bombs, on her vehicle.
I drive a big old gas-guzzling car, and I feel horrible about it.
A BMW, to be precise. In fact, there isn't much about Janet Martin that screams eco-warrior. She's a tall, slender, 50-something Southern belle with blonde highlights and a pricey pedicure on her toes. You know, the kind of refined lady you'd imagine flipping through a House and Garden magazine. And that's exactly how she stumbled upon her new passion.
I read a very small article about a woman in California who manufactures a bag called One Bag at a Time.
That led her to a website. And on the website, a statistic that put Martin on her mission.
And it said, did you know that the petroleum used in manufacturing and production of 14 plastic bags could drive a car 1 mile. If you had an option or a choice, do you want to put the petroleum in your car or do you want to leave those bags in the grocery store?
Martin started writing letters to the manager at her local grocery store.
And I started asking, well, how come I'm not getting a refund on using my own bags? So I said, well, how many plastic bags do you think you use here? He actually told me it's 20,000 bags, and I multiplied that times 52 weeks a year. One Stop and Shop uses 1.4 million bags in 1 year. They have grocery stores in 8 states.
But no dice, or not yet at least, with the chain supermarkets.
And I thought, aha, let's try one more letter. So I wrote another letter to Senator Joyce.
That's Massachusetts State Senator Brian A. Joyce. Martin's letter was packed with plastic bag facts. How many plastic bags Americans use every year? That the bags are fouling marine ecosystems? That they persist forever in landfills? A couple weeks later, Joyce filed legislation that, if passed, will charge Massachusetts shoppers up to 15 cents every time they stuff their groceries in a plastic bag.
And he wrote me a letter and he credited me with providing him the information to spark his interest in the ban.
It's not a ban, exactly. It's a tax. For Martin, above all,
it's a no-brainer.
She says that a lot. It's catching on.
It just seems like a no-brainer.
If Janet Martin seems a little quixotic, then State Senator Brian A. Joyce is her perfect Sancho Panza. He's even got the bald head and belly.
Are you suggesting that I'm not tall or slender?
Well, yeah. But unlike Panza, Joyce doesn't have a mule, even though he is a Massachusetts Democrat.
This is just one of the 50 states, and it's just one product. But I think we can, in fact, stem the tide of harm that we've caused in the last couple of generations.
And what does Janet Martin think about the fact that her passion has caught on, even with politicians?
I don't know. This is just, I don't know how this happened. It just happened.
Here's the thing. I don't really believe her, because it seems like people with Martin's brand of zeal always have a reason for their actions. Call it idealism, imagination, obsession, whatever. Especially because Janet Martin has taken her anti-plastic quest on the road. Martin has been sponsoring what she's dubbed BYOB parties. That's bring your own bag. She goes to friends' homes, invites a group of women over for wine and cheese, and offers them a free, reusable grocery tote in exchange for a promise to banish the plastic bag from their households.
Here's the facts about what's going on around the world. Ireland, March 2002, began tax the bag, and the country has reduced consumption by 90%. India is fining manufacturers who sell bags 5,000 rupees. I don't know how much that is.
It's about $125.
Plastic bags are choking drainage systems during the monsoon season.
Martin is surrounded by a catwalk of cute little reusable designer bags she uses when she buys groceries. Still, at first, the ladies are a hard sell.
But you have to remember
to bring them back into your car, leave them in your car.
Mary Rudzer is a wife and mom. She's worked in grocery stores for 20 years.
And the chicken, the gookie chicken. What do I put the gookie chicken?
Her neighbor, Wendy Savino, has an even bigger worry. For her, plastic bags make the perfect pooper scoopers.
That was the one I couldn't think of another way to accommodate, you know?
Scoop it with the scooper thing and carry it down the street and put it in...
In Mary's front yard.
Not in my front yard.
Well, that's the problem.
I don't know. Do you put it in paper? I don't know.
For doggy poop, I've got the answer for that, too. You get plastic bags around loaves of bread, carrots, potatoes. The list goes on. You can take those bags, you can cut them down, take them with you when you go, walk your dog. It is a no-brainer.
By the end of the party, the women seem to think so too. Martin sends them forth with a reusable grocery tote and a task.
Go to Stop and Shop and go to Shaw's and bug them and say, where are the reusable bags? I want to buy some more.
It takes a while for all the ladies to leave, but they finally do. And as Martin puts away her designer bags and cardboard signs, I grab her again for a second, because I just have to know. Why? Why is this middle-class mother and interior designer protesting the plastic bag? Why is she trying to change the behavior of millions of people? What makes her think that's even possible?
And I'm just trying to figure out...
What creates the passion?
Yeah.
I don't know. Are there things that I'm passionate about? Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like I love racquetball. I love the summertime. You know, everybody has a passion for something. It just comes in degrees, I guess. I just think that, you know, this is just such a no-brainer.
And there it is again. But when you think about it, why does it matter? Do any of us really know why we do what we do? You never know. The legislation she inspired might pass. It might not. Yeah, Don Quixote tilted at windmills. Maybe Janet Martin does too. But festooning the blades of her twirling windmills are grimy, gross plastic bags.
But I feel like I could still do more. I mean, I'm all the time thinking about who should be written a letter to. But it's like climbing Mount Everest. I mean, it really is.
This is a Mount Everest made of trash. But
yes, it is. It's like climbing a mountain of landfill, really, to get people to reduce their waste.
Our profile of Janet Martin was produced by Here and Now's Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up, will Harry Potter live or die? Muggleheads weigh in on the fate of the boy wizard in the final book. It's Here and Now. The second half of the baseball season gets underway tonight across the country. The only baseball so far this week, of course, was the midsummer All-Star Game. And for the 11th straight year, the American League beat the National League thanks to Ichiro Suzuki's first ever All-Star Game inside the park homer. Not bad, Bill Littlefield, who joins us right now to talk about sports, to talk about the All-Star Game and the week in sports. Welcome, Bill. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be here.
Listen, about that All-Star Game, I'm wondering if you think it's lost some of its allure, given the massive choices that consumers have now with cable TV and interleague play. It's no longer their one and only opportunity to see all the greats playing together.
Well, it seems to me that an inside-the-park home run is a pretty good example of allure. you know, an inside-the-park home run is infinitely more interesting than a home run which is only watched by the guy who hit it, you know, which is the latest trend we have. You actually have to run
yeah,
around the bases.
It's pretty exciting.
And somebody
yeah.
might make a great throw and catch you at home plate. So, yeah, a certain amount of allure involved in that, certainly. And it's great that Ichiro was the most valuable player because of all the players you can see playing Major League Baseball today, does anybody have more focus, more concentration, more intensity? There may not be a better player all around than this guy.
He's truly amazing. Speaking of amazing performances so far, let's talk about Act Two. In the American League, Alex Rodriguez with the Yankees, an amazing start. The Yankees pick up Roger Clemens, but the Yankees, who most folks expected to do pretty well this season, under 500, 10 games behind Boston at midseason. Surprised?
I am surprised and I'm bored. the American League East is usually a great show, and it's not a great show because not only are the Yankees playing relatively poorly, Toronto, Baltimore, and Tampa Bay, of course, also playing relatively poorly, while the Red Sox are playing relatively well, it would be much more interesting. The other divisions are much more interesting because we're seeing the kind of, you know, that marvelous development of a pennant race.
Well, let's talk about that. In the National League, there are tight races out west as well as in the east where the Atlanta Braves are chasing the Mets. Meanwhile, in the heartland, the Chicago Cubs nipping at the heels of the Milwaukee Brewers. So while the best records in baseball belong to the American League teams, as you suggested, maybe it's better baseball out there.
Well, I love the fact that the Cubs, as you say, are still very much alive. In the American League, I love the fact that the Indians are playing so well because, of course, a couple of years ago, the Red Sox finally won. The next year, the White Sox finally won. Wouldn't it be magnificent if the Cubs or the Indians, what a great World Series that would be. Cubs-Indians.
Oh, and I don't want to have to start rooting for the Cubs again, please. It just seems so painful. Okay, let's move on to something else, a subject that's near and dear to your heart, soccer. Tomorrow at a press conference in Los Angeles, the LA Galaxy soccer team officially introduces its newest player, England's David Beckham, who, of course, in most of the world doesn't need any introduction at all. Is his arrival going to change anything for soccer here in the U.S.?
Well, it already has changed some things for MLS. It's changed ticket sales a great deal, and I'm sure that even non-soccer fans know somebody who has bought a package of tickets that will enable them to see David Beckham, you know, in a game near you. So it's changed that. It's changed the profile. It's very interesting that when Beckham first announced that he was coming to MLS, a lot of people said, oh, yeah, this is the old, soccer model in the U.S. You wait until it's time to retire, and then you come over
then
and get a couple of years' worth of paychecks for the U.S. And then, of course, Real Madrid, employing Beckham, said, hey, wait a minute, he's playing so well, we'd like to hold on to him. And then, of course, England said, hey, wait a minute, he's playing so well, we're going to call him back to the English team, and he's going to be the hero of two of the first three matches in which he plays. So Beckham is a player to be reckoned with, and unhappily, he's coming to a team that's having some real problems, a little bit like Clemens coming to the Yankees.
But do you think he's going to sort of excite the passions for professional soccer?
I think that's a real possibility. I'm enough of a soccer fan to hope that what happens is a lot of people will come to games to see Beckham, and they'll say, oh, hey, this is a pretty good take, and it's a heck of a lot cheaper than any other pro sport. I think I'll stick around.
All right, Bill. Well, thanks for coming in. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Anthony. Thank
you. That's Bill Littlefield, who covers sports and more each week on NPR's Only a Game. Still to come, will Harry Potter live or die? Is love in the air for his friends, Ron and Hermione, in Book 7? We'll ask some Harry Potter experts coming up on Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. And one warning before we continue. If you don't want to hear any of the speculation about what might happen in the final installment of Harry Potter, this next conversation is probably not going to be for you. But for the rest of us, there's a little more than a week to go until Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, the seventh book by J.K. Rowling about the boy wizard, his school chums, and his fateful battle against Lord Voldemort and the forces of evil, hits the bookstores. And rumors about who will live and who will die are all over the blogosphere. One site that Harry Potter fans have been going to is MuggleNet.com, an internet site that gets over 20 million hits a month. The co-managers of MuggleNet are Emerson Spartz and Ben Shane, who are also two of the authors of MuggleNet's book. It's called What Will Happen in Harry Potter 7. And Emerson and Ben join us now, and welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Emerson, let me start with you. I understand that you started this website when you were 12 years old. What drew you to this particular book? I mean, what was so special about it at age 12?
You know, for a long time, I thought I was above Harry Potter. Like a lot of people, I thought, well, you know, casting spells, flying broomsticks, yeah, that's kid stuff. But I think the reason why Harry Potter is such a universal phenomenon and why people of all ages can appreciate it is because everybody can see themselves in Harry.
And Ben, what about you? Give me a sense of what drew you into this subject.
I think Emerson really hit the hammer on the head with what he just said. I think the reason that anybody really finds the Harry Potter books to be enjoyable is because they can see themselves in the characters. And for me, that's really what it was. And it was the first fiction book that I found that I thoroughly enjoyed. And, of course, with this generation of webgoers, that was the first thing I did is I went to the internet and I said, you know, what's online about Harry Potter? And I found MuggleNet. Then I met Emerson and basically begged him for a job, and then
for about 4 months.
Yeah,
every single day.
And then he finally gave in. I was 13 at the time, and here we are.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get to some of the questions that Harry Potter fans are absolutely dying to find out about. And to help us do that, we're going to hear from one of the biggest Harry Potter fans that I know. She's 10-year-old Chardon Brooks. And her last name is no coincidence. Chardon is, in fact, my daughter. So, Emerson and Ben, here's what Chardon wants to know.
I want to know if Harry Potter's going to die, and I want to know...
That's the big one, right? Is Harry Potter going to live or die?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think he's going to die, because I think J.K. Rowling is going to have him die so no one can make another sequel off it.
Right.
I highly doubt J.K. Rowling is going to be a happy ending, because she just doesn't usually do happy endings. I mean, everyone dies in her books, but I don't want Harry to die.
First of all, is your daughter 10 years old?
She's 10, yes.
Wow, I wasn't that sad when I was 10. I don't want Harry to die. I think that she raised an interesting point about J.K. Rowling not wanting to let another author continue on a sequel. But I don't think that in order to accomplish that, she doesn't have to kill off Harry, because as obviously shown through Sherlock Holmes with Arthur Conan Doyle, he brought Sherlock Holmes back from the dead. So if someone wants to write a spinoff of Harry Potter, they're going to do so. They're going to find some way to twist J.K. Rowling's world. Mm. And I think that throughout the book, she's put an emphasis on choices. You take two characters like Harry and Voldemort, and at every juncture, they grew up in similar situations. And at every juncture, Harry made the decision that was the right decision that was going to make him better as a person. And I don't think she's going to send a horrible moral message by saying that Harry should die despite the fact that he's continually made the right choice.
Do you really think that J.K. Rowling, just go back in time 10 years. Now imagine that you're J.K. Rowling and you're sitting on a train to Manchester. This is where you had the idea for the books. And you get this flash of inspiration how you're going to write the best-selling book of the next decade. It's going to be a story about a boy, and then you're going to make his life miserable and kill everyone around him, and then you're going to kill him too.
Well, I'm glad to hear this optimism from you guys. Okay, so let's go back to another question from my daughter, Chardon, who wants to know what happens to Harry's best friends, Ron and Hermione. She wants to know if they live or die.
I don't think one of them will die, but it's possible. Hmm. But I think Ron and Hermione might, you know, fall in love or something. I don't know.
What do you think, guys? A love interest there is going to finally come to some sort of fruition?
Absolutely. I think that it's been 6 books in the making. And for those of you who recently saw the movie that just came out, they've definitely put in a little bit of foreshadowing of the Ron and Hermione relationship. And similar to Harry here, I don't think that Ron and Hermione will die simply because they're so close to Harry that would be another major blow to him. And of course, he's already lost Sirius Black, his godfather, Dumbledore, one of his very close mentors, his parents, his whole entire family. I just don't think Joe would do that to him.
You see, I've read these books with my daughter, and I sort of come away from them sometimes surprised by the darkness of them. So I sort of expect one of these major characters, if not Harry, then certainly Hermione or Ron, to die.
See, we agree that characters will have to make sacrifices. Hmm. That's been pretty evident throughout the books that is what needs to happen. But it would simply just be, in our opinion, too cruel for her to do this to Harry after all she's already done to him, to kill off one of his best friends or to kill him.
Right. All right, one more question from Chardon. This one about Severus Snape, who, of course, is the sinister teacher played by Alan Rickman. He taught potions until book six, when he taught defense against the dark arts at Hogwarts. And throughout all of the books, there's been doubt as to whether or not he's a good guy or a bad guy. Here's Chardon.
I think maybe Snape might die, probably. Everyone thought he was maybe a good guy, and then in the last book, you find out he's a really bad guy.
We agree with your daughter in the fact that he's a goner. We think that it's absolutely imperative for him to die. As she said, you know, the first five books, Dumbledore continually reassured Harry, I trust Snape for a reason. You have to believe me here. And then in book six, all of a sudden, Snape turns around and appears to have turned his back on the Order of the Phoenix. However, we think that if you read deeper into the material and you analyze the clues a lot more, we think that Dumbledore and Snape were conspiring to have Snape kill Dumbledore because Snape's position in Voldemort's inner circle, he's very close to Voldemort, and it's much more important than Dumbledore.
So by Snape committing this ultimate act of treachery, he puts himself in the perfect position to ultimately lead to Voldemort's downfall somehow, or ultimately save Harry's life.
Right. I'd like to hear from both of you about how you do the research for the book, What Will Happen in Harry Potter 7. Was this just a question of going through all six books and looking closely at the text? Give me a sense of how you did this research to come up with these ideas that are in this book.
Because the website gets so much traffic, we have people emailing us hundreds of times a day, theories about what they think might happen, observations that they've made in the books. Every Harry Potter fan has a theory that they want to get out there, and we've heard them all. And what this book is, we've taken all the best theories that we've heard, and we've kind of pieced them together, and this is the most likely situations that we think will occur in the last book based on the analysis that we've done.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the analysis process that we went through was, since the book has five authors, we broke up the six books that we have currently, and each person read a book, and we split up another one of them. And then we went through and just analyzed the books as in-depth as possible, marked things that seemed suspicious, and then we compiled the clues. Then you have that 215-page volume that you might have sitting there with you.
With the final book coming out, how do you feel about all of this coming to an end?
It's really bittersweet, to be honest. Emerson in particular, he's dedicated his last eight years of his life to this. And for me, it's been the last four, and it's been very intense. And it's almost going to be weird to not have, you know, this is the last time, these are the last days that we won't know what happened in Harry Potter. I mean, think about our generation with Lord of the Rings. Everyone knows that Frodo lives and whatever happens, you know. And there will never be another moment in time when people are able to say, you know, we have no clue what happens. And it's really, we're really privileged to be alive right now, I think.
That's Ben Chayne and Emerson Sparks, two of the co-authors, along with Andy Gordon, Gretchen Stull, and Jamie Lawrence of MuggleNet.com's What Will Happen in Harry Potter 7? Who lives, who dies, who falls in love, and how will the adventure finally end? Ben and Emerson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.